this is going to, I don't know if this is going to work. Maybe we could move that a bit closer. So just as context here, I want to just point to a report that I think many of you are familiar with that just came out last week, or I believe the week before, which was the current status of systems, of wetland systems in the U.S. And unfortunately, despite the fact that many of us have been really trying very hard at this for a number of decades, and we really think that ecosystem restoration and estuarine habitats are on the national radar screen, the news is not that good. And so that despite our best efforts over the period that the report covers, essentially 5 years at the end of the 2000s there, things are still pretty bleak. I don't know if you can see the numbers here, but we're still looking at negative numbers here on the category of estuarine, intertidal, or vegetative, right? That's the part that most of us are interested in this room. They have a very convoluted classification in my mind of looking at wetlands in this report, but that's the bit that many of us focus on in our day-to-day, and it's still going downhill. Obviously, this is at a national scale. So here are the statistics. From this quote directly from the report, the rate of loss was 3 times greater than estuarine emergent losses from 98 to 2004. So this is not really good news. It's not really good news. Despite our best efforts, things are not going nationally as well as we would like them to do. Now, locally, obviously, we have a number of success stories. And what I'm going to try and do is perhaps not be quite as bleak as my first few slides here, and offer some ideas on how we can really try and move this forward, and some of the things that I think are important for us in terms of thinking about how we accomplish this and how we reverse these statistics as we move on into the 21st century. So, you know, just an example here, and I'm going to try not to use examples from Jamaica Bay, because as I said earlier, you guys are the experts on this system, and I'm not. Here's just an example of the problem that we're all familiar with, the problem from the other side of the country, from San Francisco. And for most of this talk, I'm going to talk about different kinds of estuaries, and I think without specifically focusing on New York up here, I think San Francisco Bay has a lot of the same kinds of problems as the system here in terms of it being a very urbanized estuary, or one where, as you see on this map here, the colors on the left are all the natural environments that were there in the past, and the lack of colors, if you like, in the panel on the right demonstrate the dramatic changes that have been made in that system. And so this over there, just as here, those are the kinds of changes that we're trying to reverse. And so what needs to change in terms of getting those statistics in the next report, or perhaps the one after, looking a little bit more on the positive side in that category that we're all interested in? Well, I think we have to be a bit more strategic, and I'll talk a little bit about that. I think we have a little bit of a problem, perhaps not amongst ourselves, because I think many of us understand this very well, but I think we have a little bit of a problem perhaps with the general public and maybe those folks are in Congress about what we're trying to achieve here, and about whether there is any going back in these systems, or whether or not it really is about trying to provide a better future than is currently on the horizon. And I think my main point that I'll come to there is how we can try to reverse those numbers by leveraging opportunities that present us in different ways in different places. So what do I mean by being more strategic here? There's not many words on this slide, but there is a diagram that you probably haven't seen before. So I'll leave it up for a few minutes so you can understand what's going on in the diagram here. This comes from a paper that Mike Weinstein and I wrote a few years ago, where we identified a typology of estuaries. The key thing here is that it's not a one-size-fits-all solution problem, and it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. And so what we have here on the bottom axis is a category of this is biodiversity and ecosystem function, kind of naturalness, if you like, low on the left, low on the right and high on the left. And on the vertical is this idea of the human dimension or the human influence, if you like, or you know, perhaps urbanization or industrialization. And so we identified three categories of estuaries there: the conservation estuary, the production estuary, and the urban industrial. And I'm going to try and use that typology here to kind of think through some of these issues about how we could move forward more strategically nationally in estuarine habitat restoration. And I think it's pretty obvious to most of you which category you would fit into. And as I said earlier, I think, you know, in the previous slide, San Francisco Bay was trips up. I'm sorry, I have to lean away from the microphone there in order to change the slides. So what do we mean by a conservation estuary in this typology here? Something that has minimal human modification. And actually, in many of those systems, we face problems there associated with natural dynamics. We face problems in those systems associated with sea level rise. But what we value about those systems as society is actually perhaps their dynamism and their naturalness. And in those instances, even though they may be changing and we may consider them threatened, if you like, by sea level rise, what that really means is that they're going to change. And they're going to change, they're going to be different from how they are now. But that then, in those systems, is not necessarily a problem. And so, in those cases, then no action may be the most appropriate action. And so, I was just struggling to find an example here that would really make this real. And perhaps what I came up with was the Virginia Coast Reserve and the lower part of the Delmarva Peninsula there, an area of land that is in public, or I'm not quite sure what you call the Nature Conservancy, but it's certainly been preserved, if you like, for future generations. And there's been a lot of work there, a lot of science has gone on there, trying to understand this natural progression of change. And on the right there is this kind of classification of the lower part of the system there, where you see the marsh and the lagoon and the islands. And the idea is over time, this is gradually all marching landward and there is change going on in that system and one habitat is taking over from another. There's nothing we need to do about that. It's changing, but it's fine. The second category of estuaries there was the production estuary. And I guess one of my examples there for that might be coastal Louisiana. It's where I work for most of the time, and so I can't help but use it as an example. And you probably, we've had a few things going on in Louisiana in the last few years, things like Katrina and an oil spill, and so you've probably kind of got a little bit of a feel for what that looks like from the 6 o'clock news. But, you know, just the statistics. So what do we mean by a production estuary? Something that really is important to us, not just because of its natural characteristics, but because it provides things in terms of harvest, productivity, that are valued to us in different kinds of ways. And obviously the commercial fisheries, landings, the recreational opportunities, and recreational is a big commercial opportunity for us down there in Louisiana. And so in those kinds of systems, what will we be trying to achieve in terms of restoring the system? There, you know, we want to take actions if there are problems and changes occurring in the system where we look to try to achieve shrimp harvest, oyster harvest, those kinds of things. And actually, as we work on a new plan for coastal Louisiana that will be taken to the legislature in 2012, I actually cut this out of one of the documents that we're working on here, thinking, what are our targets? What are we trying to achieve as we put this plan together? And it is those essential elements that make it that production estuary in the typology. So when we think about these different kinds of systems here, I guess the bullets are the wrong way up, when we think about what success is like in these different kinds of estuaries, then down there in the green, in the conservation estuary, natural dynamics is something that you really want to achieve. The production estuary in the middle, sustainable harvest, the kinds of things that we would want to try and achieve for the habitats in coastal Louisiana. But what about that brown area there? What about that part of the graph that Jamaica Bay probably fits into there? And scarce habitats, scarce natural environments become really, really important in environments like that, in estuaries like that, where the urbanization and the industrialization, you know, when you look at the map, is really the dominant feature in the satellite images. But there are scarce parts and scarce natural areas in there that become really critical in terms of conservation and actions taken to keep that part of naturalness. So at that lower end of the system, and here I guess instead of the Virginia Coast Reserve, I've got the coast of North Carolina. In some areas where in that green part of the typology, we can manage for transgression. Our goal there is to kind of keep these things rolling over. It doesn't mean necessarily no action, but it means providing for that change. In coastal Louisiana, again, this production kind of estuary in my example, is what could we achieve? Where could we go? Our success is thinking about how much sustainable harvest could we actually get. And then perhaps in San Francisco Bay, which again is going to be my example for now of this highly industrialized kind of estuary, what are we trying to achieve there? What are our criteria for success? Well, trying to get some of that habitat back, trying to focus in on that very scarce resource. And here I've got just to think a little bit more about how we do that and how we're learning how to do that in San Francisco Bay. You know, it's problematic there, as it's problematic here. There are very few kind of elements to grab onto. We have restricted tidal exchange, not a lot of sediment supply there, and we've got a real problem in terms of wave action. And so over there in San Francisco Bay, they've actually been trying, and I think you would probably say too that you've been trying some different techniques here in Jamaica Bay to really understand what the best way of getting this habitat restoration going is. And they've been doing the same thing over there in San Francisco Bay. And what you see on the right panel there, that wonderful white area, is one of the salt ponds. Very large areas of wetland in San Francisco Bay were not drained so much as isolated from natural tidal exchange and converted to salt ponds probably in the late 19th century. There's been now a move to change those salt ponds back into tidal habitat. And so they're not massively subsided. Once the water is let in, though, you do just have a pond of water. And so what happens under natural circumstances, the wind just keeps the water and the tidal water stirred up enough that the sediment deposition can't achieve the right elevation for the plants to start growing. And so experimental restoration has been done out there. And you see an example on the left there, which is a Sonoma Baylands project, where it's difficult to point with two screens going on at once here, but what you have, you see those little kind of bars that are extending out. These are wave breaks. They've actually been built into the design. Okay, we can flood the island, we can get the tide back in, but the waves, what do we do about the waves? We put these experimental wave breaks in. And so we've been developing over the last, I guess Sonoma Baylands has probably been in 10 years, maybe 15 by now, really trying to work, understand the processes, use our science, use our knowledge of how the system works, think about what we want to achieve with restoration, and try some things out. And I think we've made a lot of progress there, and I'm looking forward to hearing today. I think that you guys have probably also been making a lot of progress. So my main point here, I think I have a few minutes left, is to go back to those statistics at the beginning. And the fact that nationally, across these different estuarine types, we're not making as much progress as we would like to be. How do we change that? And I really think that we might be leaving a few opportunities on the table. And I think in the 21st century particularly, in the 21st century generally, but certainly in our current budget climate, whatever state we're in the same country, we need to take care of any kind of opportunity, take advantage of every opportunity that we can. So I use this slide a lot in presentations where I talk about how important coastal systems are. Why are coasts important places for us to pay attention to? And you know, one of the storylines there is coasts have always been important. They've been important to civilization as it's developed around the world, because they provide large areas of flat land, often with very good fresh water supply, and as global trade increases over the centuries, then obviously there have been great port facilities, and you clearly living in close proximity to one of the great port facilities that this country has. Dependent upon deep channels, access to other markets through rivers and railways and roads, and large areas of flat land. I mean, this is the kind of thing that happens in coastal areas. So as people live and work and are drawn to the coast for a number of different reasons, these uses start to expand. And so the characteristics of coastal systems that bring people to the coast result in coastal uses, which then feed back and have some effect on the coastal system. And so in the terminology that we all like to use now, the coastal system, if you like, provides goods and services that we take advantage of. And the challenge then is that the uses that we make of those coastal systems then produce stresses and impacts back to the coastal system. And the example there is in Louisiana. And we have a massive coastal land loss problem in Louisiana that is not going away. We're probably responsible for a lot of those statistics, I know. But we have a big problem in Louisiana, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about why we have it. You probably have a little bit of background on that. But basically, it's a combination of flood control, navigation channels, oil and gas exploration, some natural disturbances mixed in there too. But many of the things, the way we have used that system, the way we as society have taken advantage of the great bounty that it provides us, have resulted in some of the problems that we now see. And just a couple of quick examples of that, you know, in the 19th century, we really started to manage the river and adjust it for navigation purposes. In the 20th century, as a result of the Great Flood of 1927, we really got serious about managing and confining the river and restricting it into its place for flood risk management. And so now what happens is we have one of the great rivers of the world, certainly one of the great rivers, the great river of this country, certainly in magnitude and importance for a number of factors. But we have this great resource that we're using very well as a society, and in the middle we have this ecosystem which is suffering as a result. And so we need a new approach to thinking about this for the 21st century. The key thing there, in my mind, is not to elevate ecosystem restoration as the preeminent goal there. I think I would suggest that we want a sustainable coast out of this. We have to think about how we're going to get there. And how we're going to get there is not necessarily by just banging on the podium and saying the ecosystem is collapsing. We have to find the sweet spot in this. And I would suggest that the way to find the sweet spot for us down there, and there may be areas that you can do this too, is to think about places where there are many, many people, many sectors, if you like, where they want things to be different in the future. It's not just the advocates for ecosystem restoration who want things to be different in the future. And so where the status quo, if you like, works for very few people. And so we might want to achieve some kind of restoration in the wetland landscape at the same time that we might need to improve flood risk management and our protection from coastal storms, at the same time that we might want to find a more efficient way of navigating through that system. So where is this sweet spot? I would suggest that if we really think that we need to use the resources of the Mississippi River for sustainability in that ecosystem down there, then what are we going to do? We're going to see if we can find a way of using those river resources to provide perhaps a deeper navigation channel, to provide more reliable protection from storms. Oh, by the way, to move floodwaters away from coastal communities, and oh, by the way, to actually restore the ecosystem. The reason that we are going to do something big with the Mississippi River is not because of ecosystem restoration. It's going to be because of navigation and flood risk management and things like that. So finding these opportunities, I think, is the key. And again, I try not to talk so much about Jamaica Bay today because I need to catch up, and this is going to be a great opportunity today to find out what's going on. But I found this the other day, and where can we find that sweet spot here? What are the things that people really want to achieve here in Jamaica Bay that makes sense to many, where ecosystem restoration per se may not? And I just highlighted a few words on here that may be the things, the levers that we can hang on to here, that we want this, let's go after this, and by the way, get some restoration work done on the site. Obviously, today we're at a science symposium. We need to do all this informed by our science. And I've scattered that throughout the presentation here, but obviously today it's going to be the focus. Where does science play into this? What are our key roles here? Well, we have to lay out that future. One of the things that I mentioned was finding those areas where the status quo is not good for most people, where the future is bleak, on many fronts. And it's our science that is going to allow us to think about that future, to work, to think and predict, if you like. We have to understand those long-term dynamics and be able to separate those long-term trends from natural variability. The whole issue about individual weather versus climate, right? We've got to be able to tease out those long-term signals for people and help them understand where we're going with these systems. Think about what is success, how we can achieve it, but also being prepared for surprises. When events come along, when you have a big flood associated with Irene and Lee, as I think you did, just talking to Dennis about it, as you had very recently here, how does that change the system? How does that provide an opportunity? Where is that sediment? How can you use that? So moving forward, I think one of the things that we have to communicate better is that change in these systems is inevitable. The challenge for us is the change that we have at the moment is that downward spiral that you saw in the statistics at the beginning. We have to reverse those changes and think about change in a more positive direction, but a change in a more positive direction, not just from the ecosystem perspective, but from those many other uses that go on in our coastal systems. We as scientists, we need to develop our science and put it in a framework that people can use it. Develop our conceptual models, develop our statistical models, develop simulation models if we can. Don't just throw out the data. Use a way of articulating it and putting it together that people can really use. We as scientists also have to acknowledge and help the general public acknowledge that there are going to be trade-offs in doing this. There are very few win-win-win situations here. And when we go after one goal, there may be an adjustment in another goal that some people may not find desirable. We cannot back off from that. We're going to have downward statistics for a long time unless we can really confront that and help people understand some of those difficult decisions that need to be made. And I think that the other thing that we can do as scientists is really, provide a kind of structured way of thinking about things, provide our kind of analytical frameworks, our decision tools for our managers so that they can actually, can use some of the simple understanding we have to move forward. I'm going to leave it with this slide, and this slide is not any of the systems that I've talked about today. This is a slide, I love this slide. It's a tidal mudflat in Cook Inlet in Alaska. And it's really, for me, it is just a great stimulus in terms of nature and what nature does. I'm a mud and water and dirt kind of person, right? I'm not really a grass person. I'm into mud and water. But look at the patterns in that picture. That is what nature does. This is a really unaltered system. This is really one of those in the conservation history side in the slide from earlier. And there are great patterns in here. And the way we have great patterns like this, where we have nature just doing its thing, we should protect it and try to limit alterations to that. But most of us, unfortunately, have moved away from systems like this. We shouldn't necessarily be trying to recreate nature like this. We should try to be thinking about getting as far as we can towards a more functional, a better future for our system, and really just kind of be inspired by understanding how nature works when it produces things like this and using that knowledge to make a better future for our system. So I'm looking forward to learning more about what you've all been doing in Jamaica Bay in the last few years, and thank you for inviting me.
We have time for some questions. We have a couple of roving microphones, so we can hear your questions. If you care to stand up and give us your name and ask your question.
Yes.
You kind of neatly categorize these various kinds of extroverts. We're really working with all three. They're productive. There's an in Jamaica Bay, there's a natural piece, there's a production piece, there's an urban service piece. What are some of the questions there?
Well, so the question was, the question was that I've. The observation was that I've categorized things, and really in Jamaica Bay we have elements of all of them, and so how does that either complicate or help I'm paraphrasing the question a little bit there, but the in my mind, you know, one of these is usually dominant, and in terms of the overall purpose that you try to achieve, I think if you really try to get everything out, everything, then you're not gonna achieve success. That the, if you like, the characteristics of the system, I think will guide what you're trying to achieve. In the sense that, for this, if we think about this system pre-urbanization, I'm trying to remember what the geography is called. Rockaway Inlet probably moved. I don't think that inlet is going to start moving around again in a major way. I just don't think that's something that we should be trying to achieve, right? There are some things, because of the characteristics of the system, there are some constraints that are imposed on what we can try to achieve. And those don't have to be negative. I think that's what I'm saying. That's just the framework within which we try to achieve our goals. And so when we think about, when we look at other systems, when we're trying to learn from other systems about how they're doing things, I think what I'm saying is, look at other systems that are like yours. Don't look at something which is remarkably unaltered and doesn't have any constraints. Think about how other systems work within those constraints. You obviously have huge amounts of inflow from an urban area, which has all kinds of water quality issues associated with that. There are other systems who may have worked with that kind of inflow, who've taken approaches to deal with those kinds of inflow. So learn, if you like, from the other estuaries that are within the same typology. Scientifically, obviously, a marsh is a marsh is a marsh. It works pretty much the same across these different systems. It's when we actually try to do restoration that we have to think about where we are and what we're trying to achieve. And so I'm not denying that you may want to increase the productivity of some aspects of your system, but that's not the primary reason, I think, that we should be, that's a characteristics that we want to improve, but that's not the main goal here. The main goal here for me is to, for me, coming out in from outside, is to think about the great value that the natural environment that Jamaica Bay represents, the great value that that provides within this broader urban area. This is a very, very scarce resource within the context of your estuary here, and that makes it much more important to nurture it and to try and achieve some restoration goals. But Jamaica Bay is never going to be the Virginia Coast Reserve. Too many things have changed in that system, and I think that the framework here is trying to say you've got to work within that system to achieve some success. And other people are doing exactly the same thing. I think that's the same kind of example in San Francisco Bay. You know, we are not taking out the Port of Oakland, right? It is there, right? And there are similar kinds of things that go on here.
Another question? Yes. Bring the mic over.
Please, John Tanacredi from Dallas College. Just a quick observation. I noticed you didn't use the term anywhere in your ecosystem health. You had to use this as the paradigm.
Do you
want to
use the mic,
marshes,
John?
You would definitely not question the really, these are virgin marshes. They haven't been altered. They haven't been mosquito ditched. They haven't been. There's no dredging associated with that. How do you compare then a place like Jamaica Bay, which definitely has characteristics that would be a healthy marsh, no matter where you were on the planet? And how do you address that from purely a scientific standpoint?
Well, the beginning of the question, John, was about ecosystem health, I guess, and I think the difference there, and I don't want to get too far down in the weeds here and distract from what we're trying to achieve today. The difference for me is understanding the science about how marshes work. They are pretty much the same, you know, spot on rotundifora, you know, does pretty much the same thing, you know, in the places where it grows. We can understand scientifically from one system to another. I think that the difference that I'm trying to point to here is in terms of restoration. And so we're trying to do science, if we are trying to do science to inform restoration, our science can be informed by understanding how systems work across these gradients that I've pointed out. But from the restoration context, I think we can learn a lot from looking at other systems that are within that part. And so you also observed that I didn't use the term ecosystem health. I have learned long ago to stay away from that term. It really gets us, I think it just is too confusing and unspecific to really help us, because we'll all understand it very, very differently.
Very quickly, but would you agree that there are tipping points where the ecosystems can be considerably degraded, even if they're considered healthy, by some particular action, a development action, or some type of physical change?
My observation there is that ecosystems change, and that they may go from one state to another state, but there's still something there. It just may be less desirable to us, and we may consider one state more desirable than another state. And so, you know, within the restoration context, identifying what state is desirable to you and then trying to achieve that is very important. But the idea that that one is better than another, I think is a very is value, you know, is really a value issue for the particular management structure or custodial or for society in the area. So there's usually something living there of one kind or another. It just might not be what you want.
Time for one more question.
I'm glad I've stirred this up enough this morning. This is gratifying.
In your sweet spot scenario, you're implying that economics is going to be a driving force. So there's lots of money to deepen the Mississippi or to do flood improvement, and so that therefore the economics will drive that. Is that correct? Am I?
Yeah, I think that's implicit in it. In the sense that resources are scarce, and ecosystem restoration frequently comes at the bottom of the list when resources are scarce. And so leveraging opportunities where resources are available for other purposes and making the most of that was the point, yes.
Right, and on the drive down here, the oysters is a big topic of today's, and I joke that if you could get USDA to classify oysters as livestock, they'd be a ton of money. I know it's
whatever works, but, yeah, whatever works.
But if you think about it, there are other ways that you frame the problem could bring additional economics into the issue, and I think that's what you were.
Yeah, that is my point. Yeah, don't frame the issue in the broader context, and that's where I think, it probably needs a little bit more distillation here. But that's where I think this context, thinking about the context that you're in, is important for that, and thinking about the other things that are going on in the system and how you can leverage that. Obviously, the classic example there. Is beneficial use of dredge material. I think it goes beyond that, though. It goes much, much, much further than that. And so it may go towards the way in which you decide to treat water. You have using this example relevant to your system per se, but in other areas where people have water quality issues, wetland restoration has been a solution to a water quality problem, not purely done just because we want more wetlands, for instance. And so there are some small examples, and I think there are some bigger examples that we could probably grab onto there.
Okay, one quick question, Martin?
Martin Schreiben, Brooklyn College area. Perhaps we need to get away from the word restoration, and because that only leads to futility. There's no way we can restore if we use restore the proper framework for proper definition. And I think you break these points very well during the presentation. We have to take what we're dealing with in present day context and try to make it a functional system. And I think we can do that, that we're never going to restore it to what it originally was.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Absolutely. I do think that we are. I know I use the term ecosystem restoration a lot in my presentation. Perhaps I can't. I know what I mean by it, and I think you are probably all with Martin and I in that. But perhaps we need a new term. Perhaps it's about ecosystem sustainability. Is probably a better way of thinking about it. From the federal agency side, ecosystem restoration is the term of art, so we have to do that translation. But that is really important. Thinking about a better future for your system within the context of all of those other coastal uses. That's really what we need to try and go to. And my point is, can we leverage any of those other coastal uses to get towards that better future? Thanks, Martin.
Thank you very much.